Welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Micro. As always, I hope you had a great week. And you can always find Let's Talk Micro on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Goodpods, whatever you listen to podcasts, you can find Let's Talk Micro. As far as social media, I am on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube as Let's Talk Micro, on LinkedIn as Luis Plaza, on X as Let's Talk Micro 1, and I have an email address which is letstalkmicro@outlook.com. So either via social media or via email, you can reach out with any topic suggestions, any feedback. As always, they are always welcome and appreciated. So please go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, download episodes, and if the app allows you to do so, please go ahead and leave a review. Thank you so much for the support. As always, if you haven't checked out the previous episode of Let's Talk Micro, please go ahead and do so. It was a great episode where Dr. Jill Roberts from the University of South Florida, she joined the podcast to talk about the Doctor of Public Health degree, specifically with a concentration in public health and clinical laboratory science and practice. And Dr. Roberts, you know, as I said in the previous episode, you know, she has a great energy and she talks about this degree. What can you do with it professionally? She breaks it down. She talks about the prerequisites. I asked the question if as clinical laboratory personnel, you know, is this a good fit for us? And she talks about that. I also asked the question about taking the ABMM examination, American Board for Medical Microbiology. So overall, it was a great episode and a great conversation. So if you haven't checked it out, please go ahead and do so. As always, if you are looking to learn more about antibiotics, please check out www.learnantibiotics.com and the Learn Antibiotics book available on Amazon. These resources include cheat sheets, practice tests, games, and more, and they are being used by thousands of people worldwide and may be helpful for you or your colleagues. These resources are from Dr. Timothy Guthier, a very passionate pharmacist who actually happens to be the guest in this episode. Dr. Guthier, he joins the podcast to talk about stewardship, you know, antimicrobial stewardship. He talks about antibiograms, the difference between a regular antibiogram and a hospital antibiogram. And, you know, I also talk about, well, I ask him questions about what antibiotics you use to treat some organisms based on the source. And he provides excellent answers. I think as we're talking, one thing that we both notice is that we're very passionate about what we do. And, you know, he's doing with, you know, with pharmacy and antibiotics and stewardship. You know, he's very passionate about that. You know, he writes about it. He has a lot of, you know, he publishes. So he's very active. And we talked about his learnantibiotics.com website. We talked about the idstewardship.com website, which are included in the show notes. We talk about his book, which is available on Amazon. So overall, it was a great episode. Very happy to talk to Dr. Guthier. He's very knowledgeable. As I said, very passionate. You know, so he's doing his thing in pharmacy. I'm doing my thing here with the podcast and microbiology. So it's a great way to both of us, you know, to talk about what we like and, you know, spread information and spread knowledge. So I hope you enjoy this episode. And just before we actually go to the episode as a closing note, you know, sometimes, you know, when guests come in, we all have different jobs, different occupations. Some people might be from industry, some people might be from hospitals. And we always had to, you know, we like to put a disclaimer out there that the opinions that we have in this podcast, they do not reflect those of the employer. So they actually, those opinions, you know, and those views that are expressed in the podcast, you know, they are those of the interviewee. And they do not necessarily reflect the opinion, position, or policy of any former, current, or potential future employer. If you want to support the podcast, you know, as always, with your support, maybe I can continue bringing more content and go to conferences, which is what I like to do, and meet guests. So if you want to help out, you can always, you know, there's a Venmo link and there's a Buy Me a Coffee, KO-FI, which are provided on the show notes. I appreciate it. And like I said, I really enjoyed this episode. And actually, I asked Dr. Guthier about what his favorite organism is. An idea that I got when I was a guest at the Breakpoints podcast. Shout out to the Breakpoints podcast. And he provides his answer, and it's a great one. So, great episode, great information. Let's go ahead and listen to it.
So those of you that listen to the podcast, when I'm doing my introduction, let it be before an episode about an organism, or if I have a guest, you know, we always take a few minutes to talk about the previous episode, give a little intro, talk a little bit about what the episode is going to be about. And sometimes, you know, you might be hearing me talk about a book called Learn Antibiotics and a website called learnantibiotics.com from Dr. Timothy Gauthier. So today, he's here with us in the podcast. Very excited. Dr. Gauthier, welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here. And obviously, I'm a fan of Let's Talk Micro and microbiology as a whole, which I think this podcast embodies well.
Thank you so much. Definitely a pleasure. And as we talk more, we'll see definitely you're very passionate about what you do as well. And we'll talk more about that. So maybe we can start the podcast by you telling the audience, you know, a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. But first, I just want to say congratulations on hitting 100,000 downloads. That's a pretty major achievement for you. And that must be a cool moment.
It has been, and you know, it still is, and I'm still kind of just, you know, a little times, you know, I can't believe it. And one of the things as I started getting into podcasting, and especially with Mike around, sometimes, you know, people say, don't worry about some other numbers. You know, there's other people that do some similar things and maybe they hit higher numbers, but the thing that I got 100,000, and as I said before, you know, I said it to the audience, I say to people that, you know, even if I had one listener, you know, this whole process and where I'm standing at the end of it, you know, with so much more knowledge, you know, knowing so much, you know, I have met so great people, and it's just overall that alone, it's just worth it. So the 100,000 is just, it's the icing on the cake. And thank you to all the listeners out there that have taken the time to just download one episode. So thank you for the support, and I hope you continue listening. You know, it's always great when your product, you know, that someone else is benefiting from this. And I do it for my fellow microbiologists and lab scientists. So I appreciate everyone's support. Thank you so much for that.
I feel like we're kindred spirits in that regard, because you're clearly very passionate about microbiology. I'm passionate about antimicrobial stewardship, clinical pharmacy, infectious diseases. So it's really a cool thing to meet someone and get the chance to interact and kind of like share different perspectives. So that's why it's really cool for me to be here. But you did ask a question. I think, can you just repeat it for me if you don't mind?
If you can just tell, you know, the audience, you know, a little bit about what you do.
Okay, yeah, sure. So I'm an antimicrobial stewardship pharmacist, and in that capacity, I do a range of activities that help to facilitate the safe and appropriate use of antibiotics. And in my career, I've worked in a couple different settings, which includes like tertiary care centers that serve transplant and trauma and lots of ICU patients with XDR, Acinetobacter, and all sorts of things like that. Also oversaw and built a stewardship program for one health system. So more like administrative, but still a lot of frontline clinical ID, rounding with the infectious diseases consult service. Sometimes we visit the microbiology lab, and then taking learners like pharmacy students and pharmacy residents on rotation, educating them about antibiotics and their use. And then, and currently I'm in more of a clinical, more of an administrative role rather, where I interact with a group of individuals that all do stewardship across 12 hospitals and over 100 outpatient centers. And so we're all trying to coordinate and collaborate. How can we be smarter with our antimicrobials? How can we reduce the chance for having a negative outcome or a toxicity? And so it's really a challenging job space, I think, but it's also a very rewarding job space. And because everything is ID, I really don't mind, because, you know, it's talking about RSV and then, you know, Acinetobacter, then Pseudomonas, then Serratia and Carbapenem. So, you know, these are things that I enjoy talking about if it was like a Saturday afternoon. It doesn't feel like work to me, although it is a lot of, mental content coming my way. And then previously in academia also, you know, is doing some teaching and research. And it's been quite a path to get to where I am today. But I think the best thing about my job, if I have to pick one thing, is the people I get to work with. Because people don't go into ID because it pays a lot of money. They go into it because it's really cool. And so talking to my colleagues that are physicians and people like you is really one of my favorite things to do.
Same here, and that's one of the things that when I started doing this and I started, stepping outside of the lab and finding people that, in a way share the same level of, passion of nerdiness, that we like what we do and we like talking about this, and just it's okay. I just, remember, sometimes, on the bench, and I start talking about things and, talk about package inserts and things, and a lot of times, it's not always well received. Some people like to just do their job and move on. So yeah. Finding peers like that, and they appreciate that, and everyone's the same circle, is definitely, it is great. And as you said, it's a very rewarding job, and definitely, I guess, life will be easier if we just, did our job and went home, and instead of being involved in so many things. But it's so rewarding, all the things we're doing, and it's definitely worth it. So.
Yeah, there's just like balance between, live to work versus work to live. And I feel like the pendulum kind of swings as you go through your life. And, as I had children, as I, started to have more responsibilities outside of work, it swings towards one direction. But then, especially as a passionate person who loves it, it kind of swings back towards the other direction. So I sympathize with what you're saying. Like, we're all kind of at different places in our lives and trying to figure out and try to find that happy place. But again, I think connecting is one of the happy places for sure.
Definitely. So, as you mentioned, when you were telling the audience about what you do and, definitely, antimicrobial, stewardship is a topic that, to be honest, a lot of times, when it comes to the medical lab scientist level, a lot of times, we're so busy with the cultures and the susceptibilities, and it's definitely, very important work what we do and related, but we might not hear a lot of detail about antimicrobial stewardship. So I just wanted to ask you for the audience, can you tell them, what is antimicrobial stewardship?
Yeah, antimicrobial stewardship, right, refers to the safe and appropriate use of antibiotics and also mitigating the development and spread of antimicrobial resistance. So it touches on quality and infection prevention and pharmacy and diagnosis and a lot of different items. But I think, one of the things that comes up is what is antimicrobial stewardship and what is a stewardship pharmacist? And a lot of folks out there don't realize that pharmacists work outside of CVS and Walgreens. And while, the people in community pharmacies serve a very important role and I have a lot of respect for them, there are other types of pharmacists. And so you can do a pharmacy residency after you graduate from pharmacy school to become kind of like a generalist. And if you really like infectious diseases, you can do a second year of residency and specialize in ID. And that's kind of what my path was and what a lot of ID or antimicrobial stewardship pharmacist paths was. You can also do a fellowship over 2 years to kind of get to the same place. So we are highly specialized pharmacists who just focus on infectious diseases. And pharmacists are kind of like designers of healthcare in a way, because when the physician orders the drug, there's a nurse that's going to administer the drug, but between those two people, there's a pharmacist who's processing the order, dispensing the medication. And through that process, we can make things more efficient. We can expedite things. We can kind of change and modify and tweak things so that maybe a different drug or a different dose or a different route is prescribed or reaches the patient to optimize that therapy. So I think it's important when you kind of say, well, what is stewardship? Who is working in stewardship and what role are they playing? And kind of seeing that the pharmacists are playing a central role that serves in both a clinical function and an operational function to get the patient the best care possible.
Yes. And I know as I was, preparing for this episode and when you search information, this definitely, points to like stewardship, towards like many different areas. And so I know that, I also have a question when it comes to this. So as far as, maybe you can give some examples of, efforts and measures, if you can touch more on things like that I've been taking to, to achieve this effort.
Well, I think everything with antimicrobial stewardship tends to be very interdisciplinary because there's so many facets of what comes into play in the equation of getting, Staph aureus bacteremia treatment right, for example. And one of the key things that has come out has been the core elements of antimicrobial stewardship from the CDC. They have those for health departments, hospitals, outpatient setting, nursing home, and resource limited settings. So there's a couple different core elements for stewardship. And generally speaking, within those core elements, there's sections on leadership. So is there an endorsement that stewardship is important? And are there people that are driving it forward within the institution or facility? Accountability. And so making sure the documentation is there to say that stewardship is part of our culture and our organization and that we're going to put the resources into it. Pharmacy expertise is also one of the items that you'll find in the CORA elements for hospitals. So they call out, hey, you need a pharmacist in order to assist you with your stewardship program. And then action and tracking are two other elements of the CDC CORE elements. And there's just so much that goes into that, from you know, things like a 48-hour antibiotic timeout to what's the data that we have. Do they still need to be on vancomycin? Can we de-escalate or streamline? To working on things like an antibiogram specific to an ICU to say we should be using more or less empiroxacin or cefepime or meropenem or something like that. You know, fundamental things like going from IV to PO with antibiotics or renal dose adjustment, to more advanced things like using a rapid diagnostic test from the lab and saying, hey, this is positive for KPC. We need to escalate therapy, and doing that quickly and communicating, getting the right drug to the right patient for that. So there's all these different elements that can fall under like action and tracking within the CDC CORE elements. And it kind of goes along with that is the reporting, and then finally education. And education, I think we suffer from entropy when it comes to education, like order to disorder, because you could do education, but really to make things change, we need systems optimizations and workflow changes. And that's why we see a lot of focus on implementation science within antimicrobial stewardship these days, because we really need to change the systems and change the culture in order to change the decisions people make to get the right drug and the right patient at the right time.
Okay, I like that. And yeah, I mean, before I jump to the next question, just, you know, just a thought. And I like when you say, talk about, you know, education, and that's something, you know, a lot of times, you know, when I'm working in the bench and things like that, and I see, you know, I work at a very large facility, we definitely get a lot of, you know, MDROs, and a lot of times, you know, we see, like, we get a lot of requests for, like, this last line, you know, antibiotics, and maybe you're looking at the profile and you don't see that it's, you know, like that much resistant. And you know that sometimes, you know, depending on what you have, some drugs are affected and things like that. But it makes me wonder, you know, we're doing all these requests and maybe we're overusing, you know, these drugs that are meant to be, you know, like a last line when there's not another option. And it's just something, you know, it crosses my mind, and we're putting these results out there and makes me think, you know, it's just when we think about things like AMR and things like that.
Well, kind of along those lines, I just thank God every day that we don't use Clostin like we used to, because now we have things like, you know, ceftolozane tazobactam or ceftazidime avibactam, and we actually have options these days. So that is a positive. You know, if you're looking at the results there in the lab, that, you know in the back of your mind, someone's probably not getting Clostin because of the things that we're able to test for.
Yeah, that's definitely, I agree with that. So you mentioned, right, antibiogram, and I know that there's a difference. And when you talk about, right, so the results that we put, you know, the susceptibility profile, you know, that will be an antibiogram. But then we talk about something called a hospital antibiogram. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, this is a great topic. And it's actually a lot more confusing, I think, than people realize, because it's kind of sold as this simple thing that tells you what is the bug and what is the drug and what is the likelihood that a drug is going to cover a given bug. But when you start to dive into, you know, how antibiograms are made and how relevant is this to my specific patient, it really starts to fall apart quite a bit. So antibiograms are good for giving us a pulse and a snapshot on kind of what's going on from like the hospital antibiogram, which is a cumulative document that's going to take all of your isolates, and you can select out different isolates depending upon if you know you want to include them or if you have enough to include, following the different guidelines that are out there for producing your antibiogram. But as you go through that process, it kind of tells you, hey, for example, Staph aureus, it's like 50-50 for MRSA, MSSA, or your ESBL rate is probably like 15-20% for E. coli, or, you know, nitrofurantoin is a fantastic drug for E. coli, but it's only for, you know, cystitis, so that's kind of a shortfall. But it can help you to spread those messages. So the antibiogram, the cumulative antibiogram or hospital cumulative antibiogram, does give us some information like that, whereas the patient-specific or isolate-specific antibiogram, you know, would help us more tailor the treatment to that specific patient.
So, you know, and actually, we'll talk more about I'll ask the question about your website in a minute, and I just have some questions first. But definitely, you know, a lot of the prep, actually, that I was doing, a lot of great information on your website, by the way, as far as articles that helped me, you know, as I was reading and getting prepared for this. So we'll talk more, and for the audience, you know, links and everything, they're going to be on the show notes, so you can go ahead and definitely take a look at them. So when we talk about, you know, empiric therapy, and this is just, right, as someone that, you know, we we produce the ID, we do the susceptibility testing, we put the results out there. If any extra testing needs to be done, you know, MDRO, like you said, a KPC, you know, we do more testing. But as far as some like empiric therapy, you know, I know from what I read, and sometimes, you know, I see that the patients, maybe they get put on piperacillin, tazobactam. I see sometimes, you know, maybe ceftriaxone, vancomycin. Can you talk about some examples of some drugs that are used for empiric therapy?
Of course, I'd love to talk about empiric therapy. this is something that infectious diseases pharmacists could talk about till we're blue in the face and you just don't want to listen to us anymore. So definitely we can also use our antibiogram to kind of gear us towards what we could consider using for empiric therapy for a given patient, depending upon their history. So someone from the community, for example, versus someone that's been in the hospital, you know, from the community, the antibiogram is going to be a bit more helpful than what you'd see from someone that's been in the hospital that has exposure to antibiotics and is more likely to have resistant pathogens. But when I think of empiric therapy, I think of vancomycin or vancomycin. The reason for that is because it's even termed vancomycin or vocin, as people like to call it, because it's so commonly used. Vancomycin there for gram-positive coverage, including MRSA. You know, yeah, it'll cover enterococcus if you have the cefepime, but no one usually cares about the enterococcus very much. And then cefepime or zosyn covering for the gram negatives, including pseudomonas, and sometimes adding metronidazole or flagyl onto cefepime if it's an intra-abdominal infection or for some reason you need to have that extra metronidazole on top. So when you know, you start someone on the empiric therapy, there's a program out of the UK, which is Start Smart and Then Narrow. And I really think of that a lot. You know, what can we use today to start the person on the right treatment? Not everybody needs to get vancomycin. If someone doesn't have risk factors for an MDRO, if they don't have a lot of risk for a bad outcome, many times they could probably get just ceftriaxone if it's a urinary source type of infection. Versus sometimes you do need to really go for meropenem plus vancomycin because they are at high risk for mortality and they do have a history of receiving antibiotics. So I think empiric therapy really is an important part of the antibiotic use problem.
Well, and building on that, as far as education,
do you like maybe make some recommendations if you see that maybe they're starting on something that maybe the patient, you know, the history and maybe shouldn't warn something, as you said, maybe not using meropenem right away, or is it something that you do, like you provide some education on that or not?
Yeah, so like a way that you can look at stewardship from the direct patient interaction, like clinical infectious diseases way, or you can look at it from like an antimicrobial stewardship programmatic way of achieving your goal. So for example, if I was at a small hospital and I was the pharmacist there, I'd probably just look at every patient on antibiotics every day. I'd look at their profile, make sure everything looked good and make interventions directly, talk to the infectious diseases doctors routinely, maybe internal medicine if they didn't have one, if it was that small of a hospital. And then directly through that interaction, I would know what we use, when we use it, why we use it, what are the barriers for getting the interventions accepted, why people are starting certain antibiotics. I could go educate those people about, hey, you chose to use a fluoroquinolone this time. If we had gotten more information about the allergy, but we could have avoided that. Or, hey, this person had a history of ESBL. We didn't recognize that earlier. Make sure they know so in the future they can change it. So changing the workflow, changing the system, including education, that's one way to do it. Another way is to do like the more programmatic way, which is get your data and say, okay, we have this much meropenem use. Is this more or less than what I expect? And then from there, who's using it and what areas, what kind of isolates are we seeing from the microbiology lab? Are we seeing a lot of ESBL? So it makes sense that we're seeing this much meropenem use. Do we have a large patient population that's at high risk for mortality and gram negative that's in a certain section of our hospital? And so that makes sense. And then which prescribers should we collaborate with in order to promote the more rational use? And again, that's not always de-escalation. Sometimes that's also escalation. And so there's really a clinical infectious diseases frontline way, and then there's a stewardship program way, and there's not a right and a wrong way. And I think honestly, the best model is to have a collaborative dual-edged approach where you have your data and you're using your data to drive change, but you're also owning it and championing it and being the kind of the face of the program. And again, stewardship is very variable. And that's one of the themes in stewardship is just variability because every hospital has a different patient population. You know, they got a different physical facility. The people there have different skill sets. The micro lab has the ability to do things and the not the ability to do other things. And it all changes over time. So it's really, for me, I think of it like a puzzle, which is a lot like the infectious diseases patient. So I think it's a really a pleasure to work in this kind of environment and have the opportunity to have a positive impact. But I think it is a good spot for curious minds because there are so many pieces to this puzzle and you need to be actively engaged to really push it forward.
Okay. And, you know, I got excited thinking, you know, talking about therapy and things like that. And I was going to ask before I asked the next question, you know, just to jump back real quick to the antibiogram and the hospital antibiogram, right? So in order to, you know, we can to get all the right information in, and sometimes, you know, comes to mind, you know, things like the toolkits for breakpoints and things like that. Are there any like resources out there that people can go to if maybe they're a little lost on how to compile one and get all the right information they need in there?
There are a number of different resources. So, you know, I have a blog post, for example, about antibiograms that's kind of fundamental and gives basics of what is an antibiogram, what are some nuances with the antibiogram. That was with Julie Giusto, who's an infectious diseases pharmacist who now lives in like the Northeast area. She's an amazing person. Anytime you see her name, you know the publication is going to be a solid one. So really cool to kind of co-author that with her. So that's one thing that is, if you want just a general quick, what is it about that can help? There's the CLSI M39 document. If you want the every single detail you ever wanted in your life about antibiograms and susceptibility testing related to it. I'm sure you could tell me more than I could tell you by far about the, you know, these CLSI documents. And then there are various publications. So, for example, the Journal of Clinical Microbiology put out a publication in 2022 that was all about, you know, what are the updates to the M39 and trying to put it into context. And I think those types of mini reviews that people put out are really helpful because I might have a specific question about why this change happened. And those types of documents help me understand like the context of those changes. So it kind of depends, like, are you looking for the technical specs? Are you looking for a general introduction? Or you want to know like what's new with what just got updated? And there's different resources for different questions.
Definitely a lot of resources and something that I have talked to you over and over again, you know, with social media, a lot of people in the community, let it be pharmacy, microbiology, you know, infectious diseases, you know, they're out there publishing a lot of things and putting a lot of great content. And one thing that I repeat over and over again, everyone is very nice. They want to help, you know, so far all my experiences have been positive. And even a quick email, you know, people just say, hey, yeah, of course. And they might help you out. So it's definitely some, you know, with technology the way it is, some great opportunities if you want to learn, if you have any questions, if you want to find out information. Definitely a lot of people out there that they're publishing and they're willing to help out.
I completely agree with you. But think of it this way, right? When I started as a pharmacist, I was like intimidated by everybody because they had more experience than me. They were smarter than me. I was just like this new person. And, you know, you get a level of like imposter syndrome, you know, as a new grad. But then I learned that people have spent decades studying topics and they spent so much time and energy and effort pondering questions. And you want to know the answer to the question that they've been working on. So for you to ask them that question, it actually makes them feel good. It shows how valuable they are. And I would really encourage people to not hesitate to ask questions, you know, to experts, even though it can be very intimidating. I've asked people from around the world, various things, just shooting an email from, you know, their contact information off of their publications. And I almost always get a response. So that was something that was eye-opening for me. But so don't hesitate to reach out to people. They're more than happy generally to answer your questions. And, you know, they've spent all that time. So let them answer the question.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. And I share that feeling. And yeah, you know, me working in the lab and not stepping out of it a lot of times. And then I start doing this and I'm like, okay, you know, I see these people that they're known in the community. They're quite knowledgeable, a lot of experience. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe what can they say? You know, like, no. And so just a question, hey, you know, can you come to this podcast and talk about it? And they're like, yeah, of course, I'm happy to do that. And a lot of people. So yeah, this.
Yeah, and a quick question for them can take honestly 30 seconds to give you like the best answer you could ever get in your life. So, you know, and if you don't get an answer, what's the harm?
Exactly. Yeah. All right. So as a bench microbiologist, that, you know, like to think something more about what I do. And I wanted to ask you some questions about when it comes to like treating when we have cultures, and I want to ask about urine cultures and blood cultures. For example, like some examples of drugs that are used, right? Keeping in mind maybe the patient, you know, the organism is, you know, fairly susceptible, and excluding things, you know, like intrinsic resistance and things like that. So if we have an urine culture, and let's say we, you know, we recover an E. coli, so what is, you know, typically used to treat that?
I think as a starting point with all antibiotics, beta lactams are just, you know, on the top of my list. They're generally the safest and least toxic group of antibiotics. They don't always have a role in all circumstances, of course. And they're not even my first on the question you just asked. But as a whole, when I try to think of an antibiotic, I almost always think what beta lactam could be used for this infection. Specifically for E. coli causing a UTI, I think of nitrofurantoin. I love promoting the use of nitrofurantoin. It's a drug that isn't associated with induction and of resistance and doesn't cause a lot of resistance to itself, like we see with things like the fluoroquinolones, for example. It's inexpensive. It's oral. It doesn't have a lot of toxicities. It can cause toxicity if it's used repeatedly or for prolonged courses, or there can be like pulmonary fibrosis problems. But generally speaking, nitrofurantoin is an absolutely fantastic drug. And if you're using it as empiric therapy for someone with a suspected E. coli cystitis, then you're going to hit that organism like 95% of the time, which is absolutely fantastic compared to like a Bactrim or a quinolone, which is probably more in like the 70% range, give or take 10%. And of course, there are beta-lactams that could be working for UTI, but as a whole, beta-lactams tend to need longer durations of therapy and aren't quite as good as some of the other drugs we have out there for UTI. So I'd say that's more patient-specific, case-specific, in terms of what would I pick, second line, third line, and whatnot.
Okay. And then what about, for example, if you recover Pseudomonas aeruginosa?
So for me, if there's an organism that I don't expect to recover, my first reflex is like, why is this organism here? So does this person have a history of having, you know, some type of manipulation or repeated surgeries, or do they have a kidney transplant? And, you know, that would also kind of lead to some more questions about what is the appropriate treatment in this particular individual? Are there drug interactions we have to worry about? Is there renal function, dose adjustments, types of things? Is there a source that needs to be investigated in order to be controlled? So there's all these questions that come along with it. And when you work in antimicrobial stewardship, people will ask you a question. And rarely do they actually need the answer to that question. What they need is the answer to another question, but you have to talk to them for a while to figure out what they actually need to know the answer to. So for example, if you say, go back to the first question, if you have an E. coli in the urine, what do I use? Well, the first question should always be, what are the patient's symptoms? Why do you think they have a UTI? And you establish that, okay, now we think this person has a UTI because they have dysuria, frequency, urgency, whatever. And then you say, well, what type of UTI? Is it upper UTI? Is it lower UTI? Do you think they could have an abscess? Could they have sepsis and a UTI? And that kind of guides you to what organism, what level of resistant. I guess we're talking about E. coli, so we know the organism, but that helps you with drug selection. So that's just kind of an example of you have to ask all the questions in order to get to a reasonable answer. In an ID, there's like no black and white hardly. So it's all, I like literally have a cup with me right now that says it depends on it. It's engraved because the answer to every question and ID is it depends. So our jobs is to kind of help navigate to what does it depend on and then use that to make a rational decision, because there's a lot of answers that are correct. But which one are you going to pick for this patient right now?
Wow, that was great. If you have a, you know, Enterococcus faecalis, and on a side note, I really like your answer. You know, this is something that when I'm curious about something and I'm asking questions, and I hope that a lot of people are out there, you know, you just deliver like more than I ask. And I really like that. It's just something great when
you get that much information and it helps you understand better. I
really like that answer. So if you have like Enterococcus faecalis, and right, we kind of just stayed in some general terms, you know, more of out of a curiosity, let's say. So if you have E. faecalis on an UTI, on urine culture.
Yeah, for me, like whenever I hear Enterococcus or Candida in the urine or in the respiratory tract, my first thought is it's a contaminant just because of, you know, the proximity to the GI tract. So that's always my big first question with any kind of Enterococcus. And then if there was a real infection, I'd probably say, are you sure there's a real infection? And then if they were very sure, ampicillin for me is the drug of choice for enterococcus, just like ampicillin is the drug of choice for listeria. So that's going to be on the top of my list. Ampicillin concentrates ridiculous in the urine. I think it's 100 times the serum concentration is what you get in the urine. So I've never done it, but I've heard that you can even overcome some resistance to ampicillin by using it oral for enterococcal UTI. Again, I'm not endorsing that. I'm not saying you should, but I've heard that, you know, because the concentration is so high, sometimes you can overcome it. And then, you know, if it was an Efacium, I would be a little concerned because I don't normally see a lot of VREs. And, you know, of course, Efacium, the first thought is it a VRE? And, you know, where did this patient come from? Is this a patient that is going to come back? And those are some of the questions that start to come to mind, actually more infection prevention rather than treatment. Because again, to me, enterococcus in the urine, the first thought is this is not, this is probably a contaminant and not a real infection.
Yeah, I like that. And I like the fact that you mentioned yeast, because a lot of times, you know, when we're looking at cultures and we see Faecalis in the urine, we do tend to see Candida albicans growing next to it, which is a concern when we're setting susceptibilities. And we're telling techs, you know, make sure that you're checking that period plate before you resolve that susceptibility, that you're checking that you didn't grab a little bit of that yeast. And we've seen it, unfortunately, sometimes, you know, when we're going back and accepting cultures. So, and I was just talking about that with the students today. So it's just, It's great that you just mentioned that. So, and to wrap up this question, when it comes to maybe now, if those organisms, let's talk maybe Staph aureus, Enterobacterales, and Pseudomonas aeruginosa, if we're talking about blood cultures, what would be like some choice of treatment and on some general terms?
Sure. For, you know, empiric therapy, if it's GPCs and clusters, I guess with the BioFire, maybe we know it's a MRSA. You know, vancomycin tends to be the initial empiric therapy and then kind of go from there as you learn more about the case. If it's an MSSA in the blood, you probably got to rule out also any Staph aureus in the blood. Got to think about ruling out endocarditis. But for MSSA, that might be a trigger to go with oxacillin empirically or up front. And then as the case progresses and the patient does better, maybe changing them to cefazolin after you're not really worried about a high inoculum or any kind of CNS involvement. So oxacillin or cefazolin for MSSA, generally vanco for MRSA, but you know, dapto can be another option as well. Generally, I'm not a huge fan of linazolid for MRSA bacteremia, but you know, in some instances that could be considered, I suppose. In terms of Enterobacterales, ceftriaxone is my first thought, but it depends on your risk factors. Hopefully you have the BCID or blood, some kind of blood culture technology telling you if CTXM is there or not to kind of guide whether I need to escalate or can I use something that's beyond ceftriaxone. And then looking at the histories of the patient is always another key factor. That's something that I feel like it comes up over and over again. You know, do I need to use meropenem for this Pseudomonas? Well, look at the patient's history. That's going to guide you onto, you know, what you should do when the data is available. For Pseudomonas, it's a cefepime versus piptazo kind of thing. They're both fairly inexpensive. They're both fairly frequently dosed. If someone has renal impairment, it's kind of funny because it's better for the patient in some regard because they don't have to get so many doses per day. And so it frees up the nurse. It actually costs less money because you use less drug. So it's kind of an ironic thing with renal function where you get to get less drug because you have you know, impaired renal function since you hold on to it longer. And then I think it's surprising too that meropenem isn't always better for Pseudomonas. And if you look at your hospital antibiogram, you may find that to be true. So people think, oh, carbapenems, they're cannon, they're big bug, big gun drugs. But they don't always provide better empiric therapy for Pseudomonas. So you got to kind of look at your local data to guide that. And then I would definitely not use tigecycline for Pseudomonas bacteremia. That would be a double no-no, given tigecycline doesn't cover Pseudomonas and isn't great for bacteremia. And like as trianam, I'm not a huge fan of. It can have, you know, susceptibility to Pseudomonas, but that's definitely like a fourth, fifth line agent to me. Quinolones, they have so many toxicities. We could talk about toxicities to quinolones for the next 3 hours. And so those are, you have to have a reason to be using it if you're using a quinolone. And I would probably want susceptibilities to it before I would use it for a Pseudomonas bacteremia. So, you know, there's just like a list that you can go down. But generally starting, zosyn versus cefepime, maybe meropenem, and then go from there. Once again, talking about beta-lactams.
Excellent. You know, I mentioned in the intro about, you know, that I mentioned your website and your book, and definitely this question, and you can tell by your passion and, you know, what kind of led you to create this. And but I'm still gonna ask it. So when it comes to this, you know, you're a pharmacist, and then, you know, you teach, and then you decide to create, right, like a website, and then more recently a book. So what kind of led you or motivated you to create these?
I think it goes back to what we were saying about being nerds, and it took me a long time to accept it. And my wife made me look up the definition of a nerd in a dictionary, and I was like, "Oh, okay, I accept it now." But it gives me a creative outlet, and that is something that I really think is important. So if you're building, I don't know, wooden boats out of, you know, pieces that you order online, or you collect coins, or you know, you have another business that is totally unrelated to your profession, like maybe that's your escape, your creative outlet. And I like writing a lot, and I just love ID. So like having a way to share all these thoughts in my head about how to be more efficient and how to do things better based on what I learned, like that's what the blog allows me to do. And then the book was, you know, definitely something that took a long time to create. I think it took about 6 years to put together. And when I took ID, I almost failed the class because it was so difficult, and ID is so much memorization. I didn't feel comfortable with infection, like antibiotics, till I was halfway through a second year of residency focused just on infectious diseases. So like, how could you expect someone who does no residency in pharmacy or in other professions to like have the skill set or knowledge? Like, we need resources, we need different resources. And that book really provides a different perspective, a different resource. And it really is meant to complement what you'd find in like a textbook that you might get in your class. And there's other resources out there, like Sanford Guide is really good. Antibiotic Simplified is really good. So using multiple resources lets you see a problem from different perspectives. And hopefully that helps us get to better answers. And that was kind of like one of the big motivators there. And it's just cool. It's cool to, you know, use your brain to create something new. I do want to plug that. If you are looking for some way to be creative in your career and in your life, one way that you see success with people, especially on social media, is they take a career they take a skill that they've learned, and they take a skill that they're naturally good at, and they combine them, and then they become very successful. Kind of like you're naturally good at podcasting and this process, but then you acquired the skill with the knowledge of microbiology. I kind of did the same thing with, you know, pharmacy and writing and clinical pharmacy and stewardship. So if you just pay attention to what you're good at naturally and just let it happen, it also is, it's going to be a little bit easier because it's a natural fit.
I completely agree. And definitely, and I encourage people, if you're thinking about something like this, and, you know, you have ideas, and, you know, it's a great time. You know, they're definitely, like I said, your social media, you can write, you can do blogs, you can do podcasts. Definitely, you know, I highly encourage them. Just, you know, make sure that, right, you be responsible about it, and the information that you're putting out there, it's, you know, it's accurate and it's correct. So, you know, just make sure that you do your research. And but other than that, you know, just, yeah, go for it. It's great. And I like how you said, you know, that, right, you know, this is a lot of information. You know, when you were going through that class, you know, when we sit at that bench, and maybe we train for, depending on big hospital, you know, we tried about 4 weeks before you kind of on your own, depending on the experience. But still, you know, it's a lot of information. You know, you see this susceptibility, and, you know, see all this, what do I do, what this and that, and so many things that I encountered as I was going along. And so I'm like, hey, you know, let me share what I know. Let me share the maybe some tricks, things that I learned. Let's make it easier, right? And while you are on your commute, while you are, I don't know, doing laundry or whatever, you know, just maybe you learn a little bit of micro, you know, 20-minute episode, and you learn something. And
another like example where there's a guy that we make hard enamel pins and sell them online. They say things like, you know, antibiotic defender, and, you know, they're like nerdy things, but he's an ICU physician. And he just likes to design things and draw. And so that's one thing that he does. I met another physician, an infectious diseases physician, who has an online shop where he has all these like cute pineapples that, you know, their stickers and their emblems or whatever. And, you know, it's kind of like just a really neat way to combine what you've learned and what you are good at. But it doesn't have to be like for education. It doesn't have to be for like writing a book. They're just be creative. Like, think of a way that no one's doing it, and then just like do it. And I don't think we encourage each other enough to be like spontaneous and creative. And like you, like whoever's listening to this, if you are, like you're a smart person, like you're a capable person. So don't take that for granted. And I think you should feel encouraged to try to start something new. And we need to, I think, tell each other more that more, especially in the microbiology, infectious diseases area, because you're very smart. I mean, you picked the best specialty that's out there, right?
Yeah, and like you said, like there's this person called Sophia that she's another podcast, but anyway, she's a medical lab scientist, and she makes a lot of like stickers and art, and she made a business out of that. She's very creative, and yeah, it's not like doesn't do like education or write something, but with her art, she just I think she's just fully transitioning to that, making a living out of that. So that's amazing. So when it comes to the right, and I'm gonna put the links on the show notes, but maybe a little bit of what else can they find, let's say, on your website? We talked about you can find information on Dbiograms and a lot of other topics. So anything else that they can find there?
Yeah, just briefly, the learnantibiotics.com website has content for, cheat sheets, practice tests, fill in the blanks, a bunch of different types of games, like Jeopardy games that you can play to help you try to learn about infectious diseases, antibiotics, antifungals, antivirals, even some biostatistics information. But then the main website, which people typically know about, is idstewardship.com, which that has a section for blog articles about things on infectious diseases and stewardship, content kind of focused towards residency, pharmacy residency, and clinical pharmacy, reality versus expectation. One of them I actually have was written by a person that worked in the microbiology lab and transitioned to being a pharmacist. And she wrote about what was it like to go from, being in the lab to now being in pharmacy school. And I believe she's just finishing her PGY2 in infectious diseases, which has been really cool to see her progress over the years. So those are a couple areas. There's a free antibiotic study guide section, which has like a picture of the antibiotic, some things to know that are really important about it that I would put on a test probably if I was your professor. And then some links to some of the relevant articles or guidelines about that antibiotic. So there's quite a lot of content on there, and so I recommend you check it out, or or don't, but it'll be there either way.
Okay. Yeah. And so once again, listeners, when you are after you finish this episode, you can go ahead and check the show notes for the links. So this last, as we start, closing the episode, this last question, I kind of got, I did this when I was on the Breakpoints podcast earlier this year. We were all asked this question. Shout out to the Breakpoints podcast, and thank you for having me on. It was a great experience. So do you have a favorite organism? And if so, which is it? And I'll go ahead and share one too afterwards.
I think this is a really fun question, and I love that Breakpoint asked this question or parallel questions as well. Personally, I feel like my favorite organism changes from day to day. At one point, I was composing a list of an organism for each state, and that was a really cool way to learn about different organisms that somehow have a relationship with a state across the United States. But I think, to be honest and true to myself, back in 2017, I was so interested in Serratia that I wrote a blog post about it. And actually, there's a Instagram handle called Stylish Streaking, and she had posted a picture of Serratia, that nice red color, and she allowed me to use it for the post. So that was a really cool thing. The color obviously is pretty neat and interesting. The fact that it was named by an Italian pharmacist, kind of has some kind of overlap with me as a pharmacist. And interestingly, it was named by a pharmacist, but after someone who pioneered steamboat engineering and technology. So that was kind of like an interesting science connection. The fact that it's potentially linked to human miracles because of, staining the color of foods red, and maybe that was seen as blood. So that is like a whole, area of interest. That it was kind of sneaky, and that we didn't really know it was pathogenic for a very long time. And now it is considered pathogenic, and the discussion with like AMPC induction with Serratia, and is it really important and relevant to not use ceftriaxone? So that part I think is pretty cool. And then finally, the military using it in tracer experiments on humans and the civilian population, unbeknownst to the civilian population. And possibly killing at least one person in San Francisco through that, because, you know, using it as a tracer organism, it'll grow really well after the fact. So for those purposes, those reasons, I think I have to pick Serratia marcescens.
That's a good one. And when it has, when you, it's always, you know, when the visually, when we see it on the plate, when it's pigmented, I mean, we, there's definitely, there's a lot of that's non-pigmented, but when we see that nice red color, yeah, it's definitely something. So for the audience, yeah, I mean, I told everyone, you know, it's Pastorella. So I want to mention another one. So Pastorella, you know, combines, you know, your knowledge of media, biochemicals, and what we do. So it kind of makes us think a little bit. Unfortunately, sometimes, you know, we can be a little bit linear, and especially with things like moldy tough, and people make assumptions about it's not growing in this media, but they don't do a gram stain. So it kind of makes you think, and it doesn't follow the typical pattern that gram negative rods that grow media do in the lab. So it doesn't grow MAC, and it combines, you know, indolin oxidase. So but another one, and this is not visually, and my nerdiness levels are going off the charts, but this is because of the smell. And that's Alkaligenes faecalis. It has like that very sweet smell. And the reason that it's exciting and I like it, it's because, you know, sometimes, you know, especially when I was learning and coming up, it can be a little monotonous, and you see the same things. You see Staph aureus, you see E. coli, you see Enterococcus. So you start seeing the same organisms, and then, I don't know, you open that incubator and that smell hits you, and you know you have something different, right? So it's just about being challenged on the job, seeing more things, so you learn more and you recognize more bugs. So I'm sure some in the audience, you know, might be identifying with that. If you're not a micro person and are listening to this, I'm sorry. I know that one of the big things that you don't like about micro is the smell. So apologies, but that's what I like that one.
That's really funny. Definitely, I associate the microbiology lab with that like agar smell that you get when they're opening and closing the doors.
Yeah, and generalists, yeah, they don't like it at all. They try to stay away from us. So as we were closing the episode, is there anything else that you want to add or tell the audience?
No, I just want to say thank you. I think for being here, for making this opportunity available. I want to say, you know, thank you to the microbiology people. I'm not even sure what they call, you know, microbiologists, medical laboratory specialists or technologists, but just, you know, the work that you guys do isn't always recognized very well. And I think it's extremely important. I love talking to people that are in that field. And I think it's a pleasure to work with and try to progress patient care through our collaborations. And I think that's the future. The future is collaboration and technology. And that's, you know, the way to success. So if you ever want to, you know, find me at ID Stewardship on social media, I'm pretty easy to find on Twitter or Instagram. And I look forward to continuing with our shared passions here.
Thank you for that. And you know, it's always a lot of times, you know, you're right, we don't get a lot of, and right, we do a very important job, you know, and we do have different names, yeah, medical technologists, medical lab scientists. A lot of times, you know, we get the negative things, and, you know, it comes all the way from the exaggeration, like, you know, the lab is hemolyzing my sample. Well, we don't do that. You know, why this hasn't been worked on, or why isn't taking so long? And it's a process, you know, these organisms, they take time to grow, and you're going to have to be thinking ahead of time, and, you know, one misstep and it costs you time. So it's definitely great when we hear this. So I appreciate that. And it's also great talking to people outside of the lab. Typically, you know, the pharmacists, we do get some students rotating, but a lot of times you have more contact, you know, with like our director and things like that. So not a lot with the medical lab scientists. So I always love when I talk to infectious disease physicians and when I talk to pharmacists. So thank you so much. You know, this has been great, and you gave us so much information. So on behalf of the listeners and myself, you know, thank you for taking the time to be on Let's Talk Micro.
Thank you. My pleasure. It's been fun talking micro.
All right. My pleasure.
And that, my dear audience, it's the end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to Dr. Gauthier talk about antimicrobial stewardship, antibiograms, his favorite bug, and more. I love talking micro. and I enjoyed this conversation with him. I hope you enjoyed it too. As always, stay tuned. Great things coming your way. You know, one of the things that he says in the episode, he congratulates me for the over 100,000 downloads. And that's all to you. Thank you so much for the support. I'll continue bringing great content to you. So, as always, continue bringing that passion to what you do. It's so important. You do such great work. So, as always, stay motivated, stay safe, and of course, continue talking micro. Until the next time. Bye.